The merit docket, beginning with the case of Raymond Louis Harvey Jr. versus the Commonwealth. And perhaps you've already done it, but just a reminder on the merit cases, please sign in.
Yes, sir, I have.
All right, thank you so much.
And Judge, may it please the court, I am Suzanne Michigan. I was appointed for purposes of this appeal. Sarah Timmers was actually the trial attorney. I would request, if possible, to have 5 minutes remaining for rebuttal, please.
5 minutes, yes, ma'am.
I guess the easiest approach, and I'll be candid, I argued already to this court on a three-judge demand, so there were certainly questions from those justices that I wanted to address. One of the key questions that was asked of me, and I had to go back and think for my argument, was what was the prejudice to Mr. Harvey? We are dealing with 159 days instead of 152 in a fraction. In looking at the Howard case, even under the balancing of factors, for a federal violation, we don't have to establish prejudice per se. It's just a balancing of factors. And in the Howard case, that attorney had argued simply because Mr. Howard was not afforded an opportunity for an acquittal, had the court ruled that there was a statutory speedy trial violation. The issue that I present is to start with a quote. It is the prosecution which has the responsibility of vindicating society's interest in swift and certain justice. And that's the Folks v. Commonwealth case from 1978.
Mr. Shiga, let me see if I can kind of cut to the chase here, because it seems to me this is a fairly straightforward legal, well, arguably it's a straightforward legal analysis. Neither party cited the Baker case, Baker versus Commonwealth, which is our decision from 1997, and was affirmed en banc. It seems to me that is totally on point, at least as of 15 minutes ago. And I'll get to that in just a second. But in Baker, the court held that simply providing available dates and agreeing to a trial date that is outside the statutory period are not actions constituting a waiver of statutory speedy trial requirement, which seems to me is exactly what occurred here.
Yes, sir.
So if I don't know why you didn't cite that in your brief, but that case is there, and it seems to me it's right on point. So if that's what happened here, now, I take it your position is that is what happened here.
It is, Judge. And if
but the trial court here used the term approbate and reprobate, or
yes, sir,
invited error, and that's a hot topic right now. And I know you probably aren't aware of this, but the reason I said as of 15 minutes ago, because 15 minutes ago, this court released its decision in Dufresne versus Commonwealth, which is another en banc decision of this court, which I suspect you have not yet had the time to read.
No, sir.
And I'm not sure if Mr. Campbell has either. But the big question I have really is what the impact of that decision is going to have on Baker, because they're both en banc decisions of the court. And it seems to me, to the extent that there's a conflict in them, the more recent one, which would be Dufresne, is going to trump Baker. So I'm not sure you're in a position to answer that question, but to me that is the question that needs to be answered by this court in connection with this case.
And Judge, I would absolutely be limited in not having enough knowledge of either one of those cases to argue effectively.
You've got three of the dissenters in Dufresne sitting in front of us.
Yes, sir.
But the important phrase there is dissenters.
But my suggestion is this, and this is what was so... I have inherited a lot of appeals from trial counsel, and what Ms. Timbers did was probably the most zealous in trying to preserve her objection. The very idea that some rule should be that once your objection is overruled, you cannot choose a date. In Roanoke City, how it is done is you will go back to the judicial secretary, and there will be a date picked.
Which was the circumstance in Baker, as I recall. But I thought that in this case, the defense counsel said, "Here's an available date, and it does not run afoul of the speedy trial standards."
Commonwealth attorney suggested, and I think it was on the April 24th hearing. Ms. Timmers had preserved on April 23rd. That was by written order, where that was preserved, that she was objecting, and again on the 24th. When she is speaking in open court and she's addressing a bond issue, the prosecutor sort of interrupts her and suggests that there has been a meeting of minds and we have done the math. If you listen to the audio tape, Ms. Timmers is sort of speaking simultaneously as the prosecutor interrupting her, and she's sort of saying yes, 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 yes. Later, when she had a motion hearing before a different judge, Judge Weckstein, she suggested, At this point, I'm being forced to choose an available date. It's not that I'm acquiescing to my continuance. That was properly preserved. As a defense counsel, when the court has overruled you, you are forced to pick a date. And I don't say this flippantly. If you don't pick a date, the court's going to pick one for you regardless.
Which that raises the problem, and I understand I used to defend criminal cases, but that creates the problem. Isn't the more appropriate response when the trial judge says, we are going to set a date, and the judge asks, are you available on that date? The response should be, I'm available on that date, Your Honor, and as an officer of the court, I'm telling you that I'm available, but this interferes with my statutory speedy trial rights of my client, so I want to make clear on that point.
And my suggestion is hindsight's always 20/20. But how Ms. Timmers approached it is she had had a hearing on the 23rd. She had, I think Judge Carson's rules had zealously objected to the continuance. Then they had gone back to judicial chambers. And really, it's just a matter of looking at the court's docket, defense counsel, and the prosecutor. And the first available date for a jury was picked. When she came out in open court, what she was relaying to the court is that, yes, June 12th has been picked. What I heard from those tapes is not in any shape or form, and should she have gone one step further to have now a third objection to the same court within 2 days, said, again, Judge, I am renewing my objection. But she did that at the beginning of the hearing, and that's included in the transcript where Judge Carson starts the hearing with saying, we have been back in chambers, we have selected a court date. However, Ms. Timmers has continued to object. So I think she did properly preserve it. As local sort of jurisprudence should be in this court, maybe everything should be done out and open in the courtroom like it is in other jurisdictions. But the judge did come out and kind of memorialize what had happened back in chambers when they picked that date. So my position is...
Well, then what's the context then of the discussion? This is, I think, Joint Appendix 140. Mr. McNeil says, Ms. Timmers and I have both done the math. It's still within the, Ms. Timmers, yes, the time frame set. Is the time frame set? Not talking about, well, Mr. McNeil goes on and says, we both agree that it is within the Commonwealth's statutory limit of speedy trial. And then Ms. Timmers adds, as Judge Carson, as you said on the stand, you would authorize me to have a continuance if I didn't secure correct. We're on the same page, Judge, Ms. Timmers. Are you saying that they were talking, that these were ships passing in the night?
On page 138 in that, in the appendix, Judge Carson starts with talking about, for all the reasons that were placed on the record and held yesterday afternoon's trial, continued at the request of the Commonwealth, heavily objected to by defense of Ms. Timmers. Within that same hearing, Ms. Timmers, page 140, says, we are here, Your Honor, if you do not mind, to put in the order because this continuance is being on the Commonwealth's request that he is not leaving any of the allowable time that's under the statute. I simply can't remember the name of the statute. But she goes on to say that he is not waiving his speedy trial with this continuance. When you get to the portion where they are talking about this June 12th court date, it is a date by which the Commonwealth attorney interjects. She's talking about bond issues. She is saying yes, 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 repeatedly, almost as to shush him. And what she ultimately says to the court is she thinks the Commonwealth attorney is not just talking about this potential need for her to have a continuance at the June 12th date, but also at some point she believes he's talking about they have agreed to a bond. So it's why in all the case law it says we don't have a swearing contest of these witnesses. We don't have a prosecutor and a defense attorney saying, did we agree on the math? Did I stand back in chambers and say we've done the math correctly? And an appellant has the right to remain silent.
What do you think is the significance, and help me if I'm misstating something here, this April 24, 2015 order that indicated appellant was not waiving his right to speedy trial? What is the significance of that? Isn't that pretty significant?
I do believe that's significant. I think because everything that happened back in chambers, and it was a very kind of weird hearing on April 23rd, Ms. Timmers had subpoenaed a deputy because... Well, the jury was continued prior to them coming to court. The jury was called off. I think that, in my opinion, Judge Carson understood she was being rather dramatic about being upset that the jury had been continued and that she was objecting. And so I think he specifically put that in order, not just making a concession to her because she asked to put that in the order, but because of sort of all the historical background of what had happened at that hearing.
I'm not sure you could answer this question if you haven't read Dufresne, but in Dufresne there was a mistake of law that was made by an attorney. The attorney acquiesced in a legal position that they determined later was not supported by the law and attempted to remedy it. In this situation, we're talking about a mistake of fact. You know, basically there's a legal preservation of the...
Yes,
I'll give you a chance to answer my question. There's a legal preservation of the objection, but there's a mistake of fact that's communicated to the court that the date picked is going to be within the statutory time frame. That turned out to be erroneous, and there was no attempt to correct it until it was uncorrectable. So I guess the question I would have is simply, would that constitute the sort of acquiescence that would bring into play the invited error doctrine?
And my position would be it would not. Having listened to
Why not?
Because having listened to the audio tape, when I have someone interjecting in the midst of my bond motion and I'm saying, yes, 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 sit down and let me finish talking, no matter what the Commonwealth attorney is representing, and it's a weird suggestion that he's representing, we have done the math, the burden is on the prosecutor, we have had some sort of conversation back in chambers, he's not preserving it on the record other than saying you have to agree. Her yes response is not something that was accurately reflected in any of the court record. It didn't say on April 24th, Ms. Timmers has now acquiesced and agreed or withdrawn her motion to object to the continuance. So the prosecutor is asking for simply his assertion of some sort of meeting of the minds and doing the math that therefore she's waiving. So I think the position is different in that, again, she has continued to repeatedly object, preserve, and one assertion by the Commonwealth as if she is to acquiesce and waive to that. And my position would be she never did.
I hope the Chief Judge will give you a little bit extra time to answer that question.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Campbell.
As you get settled, Mr. Campbell, I want you to sort of cogitate on this question a little bit. If the situation and circumstances were reversed and your opponent colleague was here arguing that there was no acquiescence, even though there's something in the record to suggest that there's no acquiescence, let's assume that for the sake of discussion, and you had an order that said that there was acquiescence or agreement that speedy trial had been waived, wouldn't you take the position that that order would trump maybe what had been said in the context of the argument on the speedy trial motion?
And you're saying the trial record does not show any acquiesce?
Correct. The trial record does not show he acquiesced, but you have an order saying that he did acquiesce.
Yeah.
You would argue that the order trumps that, wouldn't you?
Right, because there would be... I would.
And then why isn't this reverse?
Well, for one reason is that we have the trial court in this case interpreting its own order.
But it's interpreting its own order.
You're allowed to do that.
Yeah. I mean, that's one reason.
But don't we have the trial court interpreting the order of another trial judge? Is that really what we have?
We do, but we also have this trial judge, the second trial judge, actually has a letter where he actually goes to the first trial judge and says he concurs with me.
Which was kind of interesting, but okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, we have a concurrence from the first trial judge that, yes, I concur with what your legal conclusion is.
Mr. Campbell, let me ask you this. We've got a statute that deals with speedy trial issues in a statutory fashion, and it says what it says. And so if the statute, I guess I'm curious as to what the Commonwealth's position here is, because is it that the statute permitted this continuance and therefore we don't need to reach the invited error doctrine? Because obviously the invited error doctrine doesn't apply if there's no error in the first instance, but on appeal the Commonwealth's entire position seems to be, and certainly it was at the trial court level, that this is all invited error, which presupposes there's error in the first place. So what's the Commonwealth's actual position?
Yeah, I think there's two ways of looking at it. One is that this setting of the trial date beyond the speedy trial is a tolling, which is contemplated by the statute.
Well, I don't know how you get there.
But we may not get there because of the objection.
Well, the statute talks about a concurrence in the motion, not a concurrence in the trial date. Yeah. Clearly, there was no concurrence in the motion. That's quite clear. So,
yeah.
So it seems to me that the statute doesn't help you a whole lot.
Yeah. Well, we also have all those cases where the Supreme Court, like Hutchins and Hudson, where the setting of a trial date is a continuance.
But that's where there was, I mean, basically there was no formal objection to the
right.
motion, so the implied,
right.
There was an implication, I yeah. guess, that was drawn from the record that there was acquiescence or agreement to the date.
So the second way of looking at it, and maybe the more correct way, especially since we have this new case that came out 15 minutes ago, is that...
Which I presume you haven't read yet.
Right. I mean, it's funny. Last time I was in Lexington, if you recall, I had an approbate-reprobate
right.
problem, and you had signaled to me that this was coming down. And I've been looking patiently for this case. For this case, because I knew I had this case coming up. And here we are. I have not had a chance to look at it yet. But the second way of looking at it is that if there is an error, if there is a speedy trial error, then the invited error doctrine would cure it, because and I think that's pretty much how the trial judge interpreted this, is that this was the type of thing where you are inviting error by asking the court to set this beyond the
but are you really inviting error when you're objecting the whole way through and court comes to the conclusion that you agreed to it?
Well, you know, this is how the Judge Weckstein analogized it. He said this is like, you know, objecting to a piece of evidence and then using that evidence in your case in chief. And in this case, it's the defendant is objecting to the Commonwealth's continuance, but then turning around the very next day and asking the court to set this trial on this date. This is a request. And it's not just that I'm agreeing to this trial date. This is a request.
This isn't an acquiescence. It's an affirmatively going forward.
Going forward. We want this case to be tried on June 12, 2015, which is outside the speedy trial date.
I'm hearing that you're suggesting that this was more than just saying by defense counsel, here's my available date, or here's a date that'll work yeah. for me and my witnesses, my client.
Yeah, and let me discuss Baker. I was actually surprised I didn't cite Baker. I remember looking at it and thinking, oh, this might be a bad case. And for some reason, it just...
That may be why you didn't cite it.
Maybe.
But in any event, hasn't, because of the amendments to the statute, Baker been somewhat undermined by Heath?
I think so. I think it's been undermined by the Heath and...
Well, significantly in Baker, Judge Moon dissented, and largely on what amounts to invited error grounds.
Exactly. And I think if Baker was decided today, I think Judge Moon's, at least I would argue Judge Moon's dissent would probably be the majority. That would be our...
Well, argument. I think the issue, at least for me, is in terms of writing an opinion in this case, would be, and given the refrains out there, and I realize, you know, you're speaking, you know, about... This may be a situation where both parties may want to submit some supplemental briefing,
sure.
frankly, to the court on this. But in any event... I think the issue for me is I don't think any of us want to see a situation where we have chaotic dockets because every lawyer is afraid to agree to a trial date because it might constitute waiver of any, you know, objection they've already made. And clearly, to the extent possible, there ought to be a way for counsel as officers of the court and the court itself to get together with their schedules, and while preserving whatever pretrial motions or objections might have been made, they work out a mutually convenient date, preserving all the legal issues for appeal if necessary, so that the docket can be effectively managed. Otherwise, it seems we were going to have, you know, a fairly chaotic situation. So, you know, that's the concern I have, and I don't know how we get from point A to point B with that concern, given... how we might deal with a situation like this, because it comes up a lot. You know, an objection is made, and then everybody gets out their calendar and picks a date. And if the date happens to be outside the speedy trial date, then is that a complete waiver of any of the objections already been made and noted in the record?
I'm not sure that is the case that we have here, though. This is not a case where they're simply set, here are my available dates, and the court is picking one. That may still be a situation where you do not waive your speedy trial rights. In this case, though, there was an agreement between the Commonwealth and the defense, and I will point out on page 204, defense counsel said that we had this agreement. This is going to be the trial date. So I don't think that's just an acquiesce of these are my available trial dates and the court picks one. They may still be on the Commonwealth and the court to make sure that the trial is set in the, within the speedy trial limit. But when you have a defendant or defense counsel saying, I want this case to be tried on this day, I think that is an invited error.
Does the court have any duty to determine that? It seems to me that the way the statute is framed, it is the court that has the ultimate responsibility for ensuring a speedy trial.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you know, there are consequences, of course, if a defendant, you know, waives that. But nonetheless, the burden is on the court and, I guess, the Commonwealth to ensure that, all things being equal, the defendant gets a speedy trial.
Yeah. But I think the court can also rely on the representation of parties that we've reached this agreement that we're going to have this trial on this date. And it's also, there was a representation that this is within the speedy trial. And I know that the trial court probably should have checked. But there was this representation to the trial court that this is good. And then we get to, you know, right before, 7 days before trial, and now they're saying it's not. And in our position is that it was correct for the trial court to rule that this was invited error and that they should not be able to invite error and then cry foul, and that this constitutes a waiver. Unless the court has any other questions, I think I've stated my case.
I think not. Thank you, Mr. Campbell.
Thank you.
Ms. Oshigan?
Trying to just to briefly address the inviting error. The Attorney General cited to page 201 in the appendix to suggest that somehow Ms. Timmers had acquiesced. I find this a very strange case that we don't have affidavits notarized and sent into this court from defense counsel or the prosecuting attorney about what actually happened in chambers, what was said, and what was agreed to or not agreed to. But when asked in her motions hearing before Judge Weckstein on Appendix 201, she says, I objected to the continuance. I objected to the continuance. I invoked my speedy trial rights. I was overruled. I was overruled that if... Well, she says the defendant, but the Commonwealth got the continuance, and now we have to agree to a date. So we set a date which is agreeable to my calendar, June 12th. That's the practicality of what's actually happening. Are you available on this day to clear your docket for an entire day's jury?
How do you deal with your opponent colleague's suggestion that counsel representing the defendant here didn't acquiesce, but rather affirmatively went forward asking for a date outside of speedy trial?
And I disagree with that assertion. We are saying that collectively a June 12th court date has been set. It's not as if defense counsel walked back to judicial secretary and say, I demand June 12th. It is a collective calendar looking at the court's availability, at the Commonwealth attorney's availability, at witnesses' availability, and defense counsel in settling on a date where everyone is available.
In the context of the invited error doctrine, as I understand it, it's a mixed question of law and fact. Hasn't Judge Weckstein, in essence, made a factual determination that counsel either affirmatively went forward or acquiesced in it by invoking, and he used approbate and reprobate, I think it's more invited error, we can talk about the distinctions between the two, but didn't he essentially make a factual or credibility determination in that regard?
He did, and in my brief I addressed that. I know that trial judges can interpret each other's orders, but in my opinion, not only just playing a limited portion of an audio tape and say, what do we take from that? Judge Carson was not available on that day. I think it was a family sort of incident that he was out. And he did return prior to the actual jury trial day in June. And Ms. Timmers had said, can we now have Judge Carson, who would have, at least by his recollection, been able to determine what her intonation was, been able to remember, because she goes on to say that, and this is all in that order when she's talking to Judge Weckstein, the Commonwealth attorney was interrupting me. I'm making my motion on bond. I'm kind of shushing him, yes, yes, yes. And somehow we've now interpreted that her yes, yes, yes was to agree that we had done the math together and that we had agreed, and I had now approbated to the fact that there was not a speedy trial violation. And yet she continues to say at that same hearing, he is not waiving speedy trial. She continues to note for the court, I'm concerned they haven't left enough time allowable under the statute. And that's all in that same hearing, and that's all preserved, in addition to Judge Carson's order that says she's not waiving speedy trial. So our position is that she did not invite error. And going to Justice Humphreys, the biggest concern is how do we go from here? Do we stand as defense counsel and say, I cannot pick a trial date. I cannot acquiesce in any shape or form. Whatever court date the court picks is the court date that I'm subject to appear for my client. And that's the position that we are, that after repeated objections, after repeated preservation, we're trying to pick a calendar availability. So, unless you have any questions, thank you.
All right, thank you. We appreciate it. In keeping with this court's tradition in merit cases, we will step down and greet counsel, and after that, we will take up the case of Saunders versus the Commonwealth.